dancing like a bandit, stealing time underneath the sycamore tree. Cupid by the arson.
This is KY's Whitehead sitting in for Mark Steiner, and that was Wishing Well by Terrence Trent D'Arby, which went number one on the U.S. singles chart today in 1988. We are continuing our coverage of Baltimore in the aftermath of the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray, who died in April in police custody. Last Thursday, Mayor Stephanie Rawlins Blake spoke at the National Action Network, and she said that if she was going to get justice for Freddie Gray, and that if three black women, referring to herself, District Attorney Marilyn Mosby, and Attorney General Loretta Lynch, can't get justice and healing for this community, you tell me where we're going to get it in our country. By introducing race so prominently into the discussion, is the mayor saying that you need black people in positions of power within the system to get justice for black people who have been wronged by the system? We're going to talk about that with Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor, who wrote an article for In These Times called In Baltimore and Across the Country, Black Faces in High Places Haven't Helped Average Black People. She is the author of the forthcoming From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, due out by Haymarket Books this fall, and an assistant professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University. Welcome, Dr. Taylor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I want to start with a clip from MSNBC with Davon Love. He's a director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, which is based here in Baltimore.
Because I think the Ferguson comparison is important, because I think people reduce racism to individual, you know, white folks in leadership, black people who are succumbed to white folks. And I think Baltimore shows the sophistication of white supremacy and how it operates, how it takes black figures, put them in institutional positions to give the veneer of justice when really the same institutional arrangement exists.
Dr. Taylor, let's start with that. Could you just give us your response to Davon's Love, kind of his synopsis and his thesis about what's happening within the system at this moment?
Sure. One thing that I wrote in the article was that in many ways, the Ferguson situation was a hearkening back to the civil rights era, in the sense that you had a white political establishment, including a white-dominated police force, clearly oppressing and exploiting a black majority population. And so one thing that I wrote was that if Ferguson was a reminder of the Jim Crow South, then Baltimore was a signifier of the new black power. Basically, highlighting the differences between what existed 50 years ago to what exists today, which is that you have an entrenched, in many cities, you have an entrenched leadership of African-Americans who are really in the position of managing these kinds of social, political, and economic crises experienced in black communities that have really pitted ordinary black citizens against a black political leadership. And you could sort of see that writ large with, you know, the nation's first black president. We have more black elected officials in the United States than any point in history. But if you look at the sort of average condition of ordinary black people, that things have gotten much worse over the last several years, and that there has not been a correlation between more blacks in positions of power and an improvement in the living conditions of the majority of black people. And I think that situation begins to at least challenge some of the language that we use about, I would argue, about white supremacy, because I think that it almost makes it seem as if these black political operatives and the black elite are somehow puppets of some other white establishment, and not that they have their own interests, their own political pursuits, their own economic pursuits, and that they're governing and acting in a very conscious way to carve out political space for themselves, and that they're really operating on their own agenda that doesn't have a whole lot to do with the aspirations of ordinary people. So I think that we have to complicate some of that.
Okay, and that's what we want to do. We want to complicate it a bit, and we also want to unpack some of the things you just talked about. If you just joined us, I'm talking to Dr. Taylor, who's an assistant professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton, and we're talking about the ways in which the race of the politician may impact the policies. If you want to be involved in our discussion, then join us at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner or at Kay Whitehead, or visit our Facebook page and leave a question. Just to go back just a bit, I want to start with some of the broad policies that you just outlined. You stated in your article, which I thought was very interesting, we will have a link to it off of www.steiner.org, but you talk about the fact that black faces in high spaces, it does not necessarily help the average black person on the ground. I mean, you just talked a little bit about that, but we think when we're going to the polls and we vote in someone who looks like us, it will eventually help us. Can you talk about that just a bit, please?
Well, sure. And that's not surprising, because many of these campaigns tap into this sense of racial solidarity. If people think back to President Obama's initial campaign in 2008, he certainly tapped into not only a kind of racial solidarity and connection with African Americans, but he also invoked the Black freedom struggle as in some ways, is seeing his campaign as an extension of that. So there's certainly a way in which black political figures, black elected officials, when running for office, say that, you know, I'm black, I'm, you know, here to look after your interests, that we have these things in common, and yet they govern in a very different way. What I argue in the article is that, you know, they govern in the same way that their white counterparts govern, which is that there's a constant eye towards donors, towards, you know, people who can contribute to their campaign, towards not rocking the boat. And who gets left out of that are often the ordinary African Americans who have often put them into office. So in Obama's case, you know, Barack Obama is president because of an intense black turnout in both elections. I believe he got 95% of the African American vote. And if you compare the amount of support that he got from ordinary people to what has actually happened legislatively for black people, there's a huge disparity. And so I think that, you know, that there's a way to try to create this idea that if you elect an African American person into office, that they are there to uphold the interest of black people. But once in office, it turns out to often be a very different case, so that you have this situation where over time, from the end of the 1960s up until now, you have an increasing number of black elected officials. And yet, if you look at the quality of life for African Americans, there really is not a correlation between more black representation and better black living conditions.
Okay, but I think that Baltimore in so many ways can be seen a little bit differently. I mean, it has replaced Ferguson and lexicon, and we're deeply sorrowful about that. But Baltimore, across every different level, has black people sitting in positions of power, from the mayor's office to the city council, from the school board to the city's housing commission. And you're arguing that's not enough to bring about change when you have so many black people occupying these positions of power?
Well, it's not. I am arguing that, but the proof is in what exists in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I think Baltimore in this case becomes a very important example, because if you look at the level of poverty, if you look at the level of unemployment, if you look at all of the barometers that gauge the quality of life in a particular location, African Americans in Baltimore come out quite low and quite consistently. And so the fact that you have the black establishment controlling almost the entire political apparatus of that city, you have to ask, what has that done for ordinary black citizens of Baltimore? And I think the fact that, you know, there is a full-scale rebellion in that city speaks very negatively to that.
I think we should talk about this and continue to develop this conversation, because it's not going to end. In the midst of this uprising, as we're thinking about ways to repair our city, as we're watching communities come together, there's still this disconnect that comes across in your article, but that we also see on the ground. We want to open up the phones now to Maria from Baltimore. We're talking to Maria. You can call us as well at 410-319-8888. You can also go online to www.steinershow.org. Marie, how are you?
How are you all? And thank you for taking my call. I'd like for your guests to mention about class and race, how they intertwine. And there's, you know, class differences within our race. Thank you so much. I'll hang up.
Thank you so much. Dr. Taylor, would you speak to that, please?
Sure. I think that is one of the biggest things on display right now. And it's the most significant distinction between what existed 50 years ago. And the reason I keep referencing 50 years ago, because we are right now in the midst of a number of anniversaries celebrating high marks of the civil rights movement. So yes. A few years ago in 2013, we were celebrating the 1963 March on Washington. This year, of course, there's been a great amount of focus on the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Right.
And so if we're using that as a gauge to look at our progress, I think the most significant difference between now and the civil rights era are these deep class divisions within Black America. And it's not to say that this kind of class divide did not exist before. It obviously has existed over time. But I think that it's not only that there are class divisions, but that you, as I said earlier, that you now have African Americans in positions of political power who are in some ways faced off against Black constituencies that put them into those positions of power. And so I think the dynamics of race and class are extremely important, that African Americans are disproportionately working class and poor, and often racial discrimination compounds that and makes that worse. And in that can, you know, have a very important effect on the types of struggles that people are engaged in, and that they're not just struggles over questions of poverty, questions of material resources, mm-hmm. but they often take on questions of discrimination as well.
Okay, I want to take a question from Facebook. Brian Norman writes in, and he wants to know, as we're looking at Baltimore and talking about Baltimore, how do we best talk about cities that are both diverse and segregated? He quotes from Nate Silver at 538 that shows that Baltimore is number 9 for being least diverse at neighborhood level and number 7 for being most segregated. Is that a different type of conversation when you have all of this diversity and all this segregation in the same space?
I think, well, I would be curious about how diversity, is being defined. I thought one interesting thing about, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, I saw an article that she was profiled in the New York Times, a year ago, and Baltimore, as many, cities, have experienced over the last several years, has suffered from an out-migration of African Americans. And so she was interviewed about how do we sort of rebuild the city, and that she had a goal of recruiting 10,000 families into Baltimore. And what was interesting was who she was defining as the people that she wanted to see repopulate Baltimore. And it was immigrants, LGBT people,
yes.
And Hasidic Jews, which I thought was
very interesting.
A very interesting response. And so the interesting part, I guess, is how diversity becomes a cover of against sort of talking about racial injustice, that you can embrace diversity as a positive attribute while ignoring racial dynamics, while ignoring segregation, while ignoring the disproportionate levels of poverty and inequality experienced by African Americans, and still have the veneer of actually doing something. And so I think that it's really critical to stay focused on these issues of racial justice, mm-hmm. And looking at racial inequality and calling for specific government interventions to deal with and to respond to the particular way that Black people are experiencing discrimination and inequality that leads to all these sorts of disparities that create the conditions for the Baltimore Rebellion, right. For the Ferguson Rebellion. And, you know, these conditions exist in every city in the United States, and they have to do with racism and racial inequality. And we can't be distracted by discussions about diversity as a way of ignoring racial inequality.
Well, since you introduced the mayor back into the conversation with that profile from a year ago, over the past month, she has blamed Black men for the violence in our communities. She has referred to the protesters as thugs and criminals, and everybody's been reviewing the underlying meaning of the word thug and how that's kind of the new N-word. And she seems to have turned a blind eye to all of the unwarranted police attacks, as well as the $5.7 million that's been paid to settle civil suits. At the same time, you write that her behavior is not surprising. Why is that?
Well, I think that with this Black political elite, they have a conundrum. They have a problem, which is that they are governing in an age of economic austerity, mm-hmm. of budget cuts. And the way in which not just Black politicians, but all politicians try to get away with cutting budgets for social programs and social services is to basically flip the script, is to say that the inequality that I've talked about, the poverty and unemployment that I've talked about, is not structural. It's not something that is systemic. It's not because of a lack of jobs. It's not for material reasons, that it has something to do with the people themselves. And so this has been referred to in the past as a culture of poverty. It's been referred to as a kind of lapsed personal responsibility. But however you want to describe it, it comes back to blaming poor people, right. For being poor, blaming victims of discrimination for their own behavior as the origins of the inequality that they're suffering. And the convenience of that is that it absolves political figures of any responsibility for the social welfare of the citizens of their city. And we see this played out not just in municipalities across the country, but on the federal level. I mean, President Obama loves to talk about the need for mentors, the need for role models, mm-hmm. and all the sorts. And it's not to discount that out of hand, but if we're talking about mentors and role models in lieu of actual cash on the ground for housing, actual jobs that pay people a living wage, that have health insurance, that actually provide the means for people to have a meaning, substantive life, then we're not really talking about anything. And to reduce the kinds of crises that we are seeing in American cities across the country to an absence of role models, to an absence of morality, to an absence of personal grit and willpower is insulting. it's insulting. And when the entire Western world for the last several years has been talking about how economies were crashed because of the activity of banks, especially in Baltimore, the predatory behavior of banks like Wells Fargo,
right.
To then discount that and focus the discussion and train the discussion on the morality of Black people is insulting and is racist itself. And so what I'm arguing is that we have to get away from this kind of individualized analysis of what is happening in Baltimore and cities across this country and get back to a systemic understanding that looks to government policy, the practices of private institutions as being at the root of the inequality that is strangling our cities today.
Well, we have time for one more phone call before we go to the break. I'd like to get to Clarence from Baltimore. Clarence, thank you for calling us.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Whitehead. I always look at it, and I pound this in everyone I come in contact with. It's social segregation by economic deprivation and educational deprivation. When you're in that triangle, mm-hmm. you're in a loop. Now, when you're Black officials in power, as a collective, you should be operating to change law to effect changes that keep this form of institutionalized racism in place. That should be your primary concern, whether or not you have a disconnect with personal contact with the community on an everyday basis. That's one thing. But you're in a position where you can see it from the standpoint of law. And if you can't institution and put up a fight mm-hmm. against that verbally and with the ink pen, then the Black community has no need for you.
Thank you so much, Clarence. We really appreciate you calling. Dr. Taylor, just to take into account what Clarence said and the fact that the uprising is really here in Baltimore just getting started. School is almost done and we're probably in for a long, hot summer. Mm-hmm. Where do you think we go from here? Kind of wrap us up here.
Well, just the one thing Clarence said, I think that we can't assume that Black elected officials have the same interest as Black ordinary people. I've tried to say that many different ways, but I think that that is important to understand, because without that understanding, then we expect things from them that are really unrealistic for any elected official in the United States, whose reelection and election constantly rely on wealthy donors and not the input of ordinary people. In terms of where do we go from here, I think that Baltimore and Ferguson show a certain direction that is important. And the reality is that the actions of ordinary citizens in Baltimore and in Ferguson and in other places where there have been that have made up the kind of guts of this Black Lives Matter movement have shown that these protests have been significantly more effective and important in highlighting the conditions that ordinary Black people are living in than any number of Black elected officials have been able to do over the last several years. And so I think that we actually, and you can't just, rebellions are important in exposing the underlying conditions, but there comes a point where you can't just, that they aren't enough in and of themselves to fundamentally transform those conditions. And so I believe that we have to create networks of activists and organizers and ordinary people on the ground, that we have to put forth demands, that we have to connect with those in the labor movement and beyond, that we have to broaden out this movement to show the ways in which all of us are affected by the poverty and inequality that racks our cities. And we all have a role to play in transforming that. But that transformation is going to come from the bottom up. It's going to come through building mass political movements and not putting our futures in the hands of elected officials who really, from whatever race, ethnicity, political party, the Democrats and Republicans have shown consistently that when we put them first, as Malcolm X used to say, they put us dead last.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor. She's the author of the forthcoming From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation and an assistant professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University for joining us this morning here on The Mark Steiner Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I want to remind you that The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I sit down with two lawyers from the Public Defender's Office to discuss some of the legal issues wrapped up in the arrest of hundreds of protesters in Baltimore during the Baltimore uprising. You don't want to miss it. Stay with us. And on our way to break, we're hearing What Becomes of the Brokenhearted by Jimmy Ruffin, who was born on this day in 1939.